Imagine your company just deployed this brand new artificial intelligence tool to screen resumes.
Right.
And it is saving your human resources department literally thousands of hours.
Yeah.
You're celebrating this massive boost in efficiency.
Yeah, high fives all around.
Exactly. Yeah. And then an EU regulator knocks on your door with a 35 million euro fine because that shiny new software technically constitutes an unacceptable risk under international law.
Ouch. Yeah, that's a bad day at the office.
Right. Suddenly, the technology isn't your biggest problem at all. Your organizational blind spots are.
Absolutely.
So today, we are decoding how modern organizations actually survive and adapt to massive structural shifts like this one. We are looking at a really unique stack of sources today.
We really are.
Yeah, we've got university breakdowns on organizational DNA, corporate board reporting strategies, the groundbreaking EU AI Act, and insights into the rise of a brand new executive role, the chief AI officer.
A lot of ground to cover.
It is. Okay, let's unpack this. Whether you are working for a local charity, a massive Fortune 500 company, or, you know, you're just trying to understand the modern workforce you're navigating every day, the way your organization is fundamentally structured will completely dictate how it handles the most disruptive technology of our time.
It really is the absolute foundational layer. I mean, before assessing how any group handles a disruption like artificial intelligence, we have to look at the structural DNA of the organization itself.
Right.
The sources we have from Norwich University point out that the two main vehicles we use to organize human effort, so for-profits and nonprofits, they're built for entirely different terrains. And that DNA dictates their survival strategy right off the bat.
The breakdown on that organizational DNA, it totally shifts how you view everyday companies. I mean, it goes way beyond just tax-exempt status.
Oh, for sure.
It fundamentally starts with purpose and funding. A for-profit exists to generate revenue, right? Mm. To create valuable consumer products. And it's fueled by investors, venture capital, sales.
Yeah, it's very straightforward in that sense.
But a nonprofit's primary mission is philanthropic or social. They advocate for a cause, and their fuel comes from donations, government grants, crowdfunding.
And because that fuel is completely different, their communication loop operates in entirely different realities.
How so?
Well, for-profits have a very defined, tight target consumer loop. They sell a product, they gather market feedback, they iterate, and they sell more.
Right. Very clean.
Exactly. But nonprofits, they have a highly diverse, complex audience. They are not simply talking to customers.
They have to juggle a lot of different groups.
Yes. They have to communicate simultaneously with individual donors, corporate sponsors, community volunteers, the general public. A single misstep in messaging can alienate a crucial pillar of their support.
Wow. Yeah. And the leadership contrast in the sources really highlights why these groups move at such different speeds.
Oh, the speed difference is wild.
Right. In a for-profit, you have stakeholders and executives operating on direct personal financial incentives.
Yeah.
Like if the company hits its KPIs, those leaders get bonuses.
Yeah. The decision-making is heavily streamlined toward those metrics.
But a nonprofit is typically led by a board of directors, which, and this blew my mind, can range anywhere from 25 to 100 members.
Yeah. Governing an organization with a 100-person board is basically a logistical high-wire act.
I can't even imagine.
And crucially, these board members, they have no direct financial ownership or profit incentive in the organization.
Oh, right.
Their mandate is to balance strict financial realities alongside broader social or environmental missions. So building consensus among 100 uncompensated individuals with totally diverse priorities, it requires an incredibly slow, deliberate governance process.
Which naturally creates two completely different organizational cultures.
Cool.
The for-profit culture is driven by those financial metrics, speed, and paid staff. The nonprofit culture relies heavily on consensus and community-oriented volunteers. It really is, it's like comparing a sports car to a city bus.
That is a great analogy.
Yeah, like a sports car is built for speed, profit, agility, and it's driven by a few people with a clear destination and high-octane fuel.
Right.
But the city bus is built for the community. It's fueled by public support, carrying a huge, diverse group of passengers, and it's steered by a massive committee that basically has to agree on every single stop.
That visualization captures the core tension perfectly. So when a massive paradigm shift like artificial intelligence arrives, basically a Category 5 storm hitting the road, those vehicles are going to react based on their engineering.
Which makes sense.
Right. A for-profit sports car will immediately look at the AI storm and ask, well, how do we harness the wind?
How do we go faster?
Exactly. They want to know how this technology improves KPIs, increases revenue, slashes overhead. They're going to adopt the technology swiftly, sometimes even recklessly, just to maintain a competitive edge.
Well, the city bus basically has to pull over and hold a town hall meeting.
Exactly. The nonprofit has to navigate how this new tech serves its diverse community without destroying its volunteer base.
Right, because if they automate too much.
Yeah, if a nonprofit rapidly automates a data entry or outreach task that, say, a dedicated group of senior volunteers has done for a decade, they risk severing that vital community connection.
Wow.
They have to constantly weigh the raw efficiency of the algorithm against the social fabric of their mission.
Which means if you are working inside one of these organizations, your daily experience of AI adoption is entirely dictated by whether you are in the sports car or the bus.
100%.
But regardless of which vehicle you are driving, every single organization just slammed into the exact same massive regulatory speed bump, the European Union's Artificial Intelligence Act.
Ah, yes, the EU AI Act, passed in early 2024 and entering into force in August 2024. And this is a global first.
It's a huge deal.
It really is. It has extraterritorial reach, much like the GDPR did for data privacy. Basically, if you have users, customers, or employees in the EU, this framework applies to you.
Okay, so it's impossible to ignore.
Right. And the legislation takes a very strict product safety approach. It categorizes AI systems entirely by their potential risk to human rights and safety.
Yeah, the sources outline these tiers. The highest tier is unacceptable risk. And the regulators, I mean, they don't leave much gray area here.
No, they do not.
These applications are just banned outright. We're talking about AI that manipulates human behavior, uses real-time remote biometric identification in public spaces, so like sweeping facial recognition, crowd surveillance.
Very dystopian stuff.
Exactly. And social scoring systems. Like if your algorithm ranks individuals based on socioeconomic status to determine their access to public services, it is straight up illegal.
And then the next tier down is high risk, which covers AI deployed in critical infrastructure, health, education, recruitment, and law enforcement.
Okay.
The compliance mechanisms here are intense. Organizations cannot just pinky promise their AI is safe.
Right.
They have to mathematically and procedurally prove it. They must ensure cybersecurity, guarantee human oversight, and critically conduct a fundamental rights impact assessment, or FRIA, before the system is ever deployed.
Okay, so FRIA is essentially an environmental impact study, but for human rights.
That's exactly it.
So a company has to map out exactly how their resume screening AI, for example, might inadvertently discriminate against specific demographics.
Yeah.
And they have to document the exact technical guardrails they built to prevent that harm.
Right. And below that, you have limited risk, which targets things like deepfakes and chatbots. The primary mechanism there is just transparency. You must clearly inform the user they are interacting with synthetic media or an AI agent.
Which makes sense.
Yeah. And finally, minimal risk covers everyday applications, spam filters, video game AI, which remain largely unregulated.
Right.
But what makes the act particularly complex is that regulators basically had to retroactively adapt it to address general purpose AI.
Right. The models like ChatGPT, the industry calls them foundation models, essentially
Yeah.
the massive underlying brains that are trained on vast amounts of internet data and power, countless other smaller applications.
Exactly. For these foundation models, the rules pivot toward upstream accountability.
What does that mean in practice?
It means companies must publish detailed, highly technical summaries of the exact data sets they use to train the models. They have to adopt and prove strict copyright compliant policies.
Wow.
And if the foundation model is deemed highly capable, meaning it possesses enough computing power to pose a systemic risk to society, it faces even more aggressive evaluations and mandatory adversarial testing.
Adversarial testing.
Yeah, where independent teams actively try to break the AI's safety
Yeah,
protocols.
that is wild. And the financial hammer behind all of this is just staggering.
It's massive.
The penalties for violating these tiers can reach up to 35 million euros, or up to 7% of a company's global annual turnover, whichever is higher.
Yeah, that is a fine designed to bankrupt negligent companies.
Seriously. It forces AI compliance onto the agenda of every single board of directors. But looking closely at the sources, there is this glaring tension in the framework.
Yes, the exemptions.
Right. There are complete exemptions for military, national security, and pure scientific research. I mean, aren't we leaving the absolute most dangerous applications of AI weapons and state surveillance completely unregulated by this massive safety act?
This friction point is central to the global debate right now. Just impartially speaking, the EU policymakers argue that defense and national security fall completely outside the jurisdiction of a consumer product safety framework.
Okay.
They maintain that those domains are governed by separate international treaties, military doctrines, specific national laws.
But human rights organizations vehemently disagree with that compartmentalization.
They do.
The sources show Amnesty International, for example, strongly criticizes the act for these specific loopholes. They argue the framework fails to protect marginalized people, specifically migrants and refugees.
Right.
Their stance is that national security exemptions allow border agencies to deploy draconian, unvetted AI surveillance technologies. It effectively creates a two-tiered system.
Yeah, where everyday consumers are protected by FRAAs, but vulnerable populations at borders are not.
Exactly. And beyond those exemptions, legal scholars and the sources raise another deeply concerning phenomenon called the synthetic outlaw problem.
Oh, this is fascinating.
Yeah, it exposes the fundamental flaw in relying solely on compliance-based checklists. The synthetic outlaw occurs when a company optimizes its AI system just enough to pass the legal conformity assessments of the EU AI Act, but completely misses or, you know, willfully ignores the actual human rights impact in the real world.
It is exactly like a shady car mechanic passing an emissions test.
Yeah.
The mechanic plugs into your car's computer, resets the engine codes, hands you a certificate saying the vehicle is legally compliant.
Yep.
But the moment you drive off the lot, the tailpipe is still blowing thick black smoke into the neighborhood. The system technically follows the rules on paper, but the real-world harm remains completely unmitigated.
Because compliance does not automatically guarantee safety.
Exactly. So, facing the threat of 35 million euro fines, the logistical nightmare of fundamental rights assessments, and the reputational risk of becoming a synthetic outlaw, organizations are realizing they cannot just dump AI integration on their IT department.
No way. IT is already overworked.
Right. The IT department is built to manage infrastructure, server uptime, software deployment. They are not equipped to manage deep organizational psychology, complex legal ethics, and cross-departmental change management.
Which brings us to one of the most significant structural shifts in modern corporate leadership, the rise of the chief AI officer, or CEO.
The CEO, yes.
The sources from A's Business School frame this beautifully. AI is not just a software update, right? It's a general-purpose technology. They compare it to the invention of electricity.
It's a massive shift.
It completely redefines how every single facet of the business operates, from the supply chain to the marketing department.
Yet, despite the narrative that AI is everywhere, the actual integration is incredibly fragmented right now.
Yeah, the sources have this crazy stat.
From Section HQ, right?
Yes. 85% of workers do not use AI for business value yet. We have this massive adoption gap.
Huge gap. And the CIO role exists specifically to bridge the chasm between the theoretical power of the technology and the daily habits of the workforce. The research points out that to fix this, leadership has to deliberately create an environment where employees are encouraged to just mess around with AI.
That concept of play is so counterintuitive to traditional corporate culture.
It really is.
But it makes perfect sense here. Unlike a standard spreadsheet software that has fixed buttons and menus, AI is fluid. It's conversational.
Right. You can't just memorize a manual.
No, you cannot hand an employee a manual and expect them to master it. They have to organically discover how it assists their specific workflows.
Exactly.
The sources emphasize that companies must actively pay and promote their internal AI champions, those early adopters who are figuring it out and casually teaching their peers. If you just make AI an unpaid extra responsibility, adoption will stall out entirely.
And that's why the CAIO's mandate is structured around three critical pillars.
Okay, what are they?
First, they must define the AI ambition. They have to sift through the hype and determine which AI projects are merely exploratory experiments and which ones need to be industrialized and scaled across the entire company.
That makes sense.
Second, they drive cultural change by promoting deep data literacy. It is less about teaching the algorithm and more about ensuring the humans understand how to critically evaluate the outputs of the algorithm.
Right. And the third pillar is bridging the gap between the isolated technology teams and the actual business units. The sources make a really vital point here. If AI adoption is just an edict forced down from a central committee, the staff will instinctively resist it.
Oh, absolutely. Nobody likes top-down mandates.
Right. The CIO has to ensure the technology is deployed to solve real, painful problems for the business units, making their jobs easier, not just making them feel more surveilled.
And throughout all of this, the CIO must navigate a framework the sources call FATE.
FATE.
Yes. It stands for fairness, accountability, transparency, and ethics.
Okay, let's break that down.
Fairness involves rigorously auditing the models to ensure they don't perpetuate historical biases hidden in their training data, like a resume screener automatically downgrading female candidates because it was trained on a male-dominated data set.
Right. Then accountability tackles the legal liability. If an AI system makes a flawed medical diagnosis or denies a mortgage application based on a biased parameter, who is legally and morally responsible?
It's a huge question.
You cannot put a neural network on trial.
No, you cannot.
So the CIIO has to establish clear chains of human oversight.
Then you have transparency, which requires dealing with the black box nature of these models. If regulators or customers demand to know how the algorithm reached its conclusion, the company must be able to explain the logic.
Which is really hard with some of these models.
Extremely hard. But if the AI's decision-making process is entirely opaque, the organization is immediately in violation of transparency mandates.
Wow.
And finally, ethics covers the profound dilemmas of deploying autonomous systems in high-stakes environments, dictating the ultimate boundaries of what the AI is permitted to do.
The friction here is profound. So the CIIO isn't just the chief mechanic, they're the driving instructor.
That's a great way to put it.
They're standing at the intersection of two completely different timelines. Technology advances exponentially, but human organizational culture evolves linearly.
Humans do not download updates to their habits overnight.
Right. The CIIO's real job is managing that human psychology, slowing down the tech just enough and speeding up the culture just enough so they can actually work together without crashing into the fate hurdles.
And this naturally escalates to the very top of the organizational food chain. The CIIO and the compliance teams are down in the trenches doing the heavy lifting, but ultimately, the organization's board of directors holds the ultimate fiduciary and legal responsibility.
Whether it's that slow-moving 100-person nonprofit board or a hyper-focused corporate stakeholder board.
Exactly. If the AI system violates the EU AI Act, the board is on the hook.
This presents a massive communication challenge. The CIIO has to report this highly technical, legally fraught reality to a room full of busy executives.
It's tough.
If they drop a 100-page report detailing deep learning parameters, algorithmic weights, and token costs, which, for those who don't know, is literally the fraction of a cent price you pay the provider every single time the AI processes a piece of a word, the board members are going to zone out entirely.
Yeah, their eyes will glaze over immediately. It requires an entirely different language.
Right.
The NAVX sources on compliance program board reporting detail how to translate technical operations into executive strategy. Board members expect vetted, high-level data converted into actionable business plans.
Okay, so what does that look like?
Crucially, this starts with an executive summary that immediately highlights resource challenges. The board doesn't want a technology lesson. They want to know if the CIIO needs more budget to mitigate a massive legal risk.
The sources outline five keys to successful board reporting in this space. First, maintain a consistent format. Do not reinvent the dashboard every quarter. Just train the board on how to read the data.
Yes.
Second, provide strategic context. Never present raw data without explaining the why behind it.
Third is benchmark data. This is how you win board approval for resources.
Give me an example.
So, if the CIIO requests $1 million to increase AI safety training hours, they need to show how their current training hours compare to the peer median in their industry. It logically justifies the request by showing exactly where the company is lagging behind its competitors.
Oh, that's smart. Fourth is outcome-driven reporting. So focusing on what was actually achieved, not just what was attempted.
Right.
And fifth is establishing the right frequency. The standard is quarterly and annual reports, supplemented by off-cycle deep dives when a specific new risk, like, say, a major update to the EU AI Act, emerges.
The sources provide a really tangible example of how to execute this less is more philosophy. They compare this new wave of reporting to a public company's 10K filing.
Okay, the 10K.
Yeah, a 10K is a comprehensive, standardized summary of a company's financial performance and risks. AI risk assessment is moving toward that exact level of rigorous, standardized disclosure. The board needs the AI equivalent of financial highlights, not the raw receipts.
The way the sources demonstrate this with hotline data is brilliant.
It really is.
Instead of handing the board a massive spreadsheet of compliance hotline calls, the report synthesizes it into a narrative. It states, quote, "Our anonymous call rate to the ethics hotline is 33%, but our industry benchmark median is 25%.
And boom, that immediately establishes the benchmark and the context.
Right. Then it provides the strategic, human-centric solution. It says, anonymous calls are significantly harder to investigate and resolve. Therefore, we are implementing targeted anti-retaliation training this quarter to lower this rate and ensure employees feel safe identifying themselves.
That is masterclass board reporting.
Truly.
It takes a raw metric, explains why it represents an operational risk, compares it to the industry, and provides a clear human solution that the board can actually fund. A CIIO must apply this exact methodology to AI.
Right.
They shouldn't report on how many neural network layers the new model has. They should report on what percentage of the workforce has completed copyright infringement training under the EU AI Act compared to industry medians, and what the plan is to close any gaps.
It's all about translating exponential, abstract technology back into linear human governance.
Precisely.
Well, we have covered incredible ground today. Let's synthesize this journey for you, the listener. We started by examining the very DNA of organizations, revealing how the fundamental differences in purpose, funding, and leadership between the sports car of a for-profit and the city bus of a nonprofit dictate how they survive technological storms.
And from that foundation, we explored the external shock of the EU AI Act. We analyzed the rigid risk categorization, the severe financial penalties, the mechanisms of those fundamental rights impact assessments, and the critical global debate surrounding military exemptions and the dangerous illusion of the synthetic outlaw.
We then met the internal solution to this crisis, the chief AI officer. We explored how their mandate isn't just technical, but deeply cultural, you know, bridging the massive adoption gap by fostering an environment of play, paying internal champions, and navigating the profound hurdles of fairness, accountability, transparency, and ethics.
Finally, we brought it to the boardroom, examining how CIOs translate complex algorithmic risks into the standardized language of benchmarks and resource allocations, which allows busy boards to effectively govern technology they might not fully understand.
So why does all of this matter to you? Whether you are preparing to present at a C-suite meeting, volunteering your time at a massive nonprofit, or simply trying to stay relevant in a workforce that is shifting beneath your feet, understanding these forces gives you a massive advantage.
Definitely.
You are no longer just looking at the software on your screen. You are seeing the underlying structural DNA and regulatory pressures that are forcing your organization to make the decisions it makes.
You understand the actual mechanics of the machine you are operating within.
But I want to leave you with a final thought today. Something to mull over that builds on everything we just discussed.
All right, what is it?
We explored how the sources view AI as a general-purpose technology, the new electricity.
Yeah.
Right now, organizations are terrified of 35 million euro fines and massive adoption gaps, so they are scrambling to hire these chief electricity officers, the CAIOs, to save them.
Right.
But what happens in 10 or 15 years? We don't have a chief electricity officer today. We don't have a chief internet officer. Will the CAIO role completely disappear? Because eventually, artificial intelligence will become as invisible, ubiquitous, and mundane as the power grid humming inside your office walls.
Yeah.
And when the storm passes and this just becomes the invisible new normal. Oh, wait, no, let me rephrase that. When this just becomes the normal everyday reality, who is going to be driving the vehicle then?
That is a fascinating question to end on.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We will catch you next time.